No, wrong side.
Why didn't you put it right side up?
I did put it right side. Yes, I did. No. Yes, I did.
Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Hey there goes the Spider-Man. Does whatever a spider can. Shooby-Doo, rock steady crew. Find him an octoped ingenue with flair. There goes the Spider-Man. In the heat of night, at the scene of a crime, with the speed of light, he arrives just in time. Ooh. Well, no red-blooded boy or girl would miss this Saturday.
Is my mic happening?
Yeah.
All right. Linoleum knife.
Yes.
For a second, while you were queuing up your cassette, I thought you were fixing to play that that tender breastfeeding REM song that's on this tape before.
No.
That, and I was going to actually call the show Tender Breastfeeding because of it, just as, you know, a joke, and then I didn't do it.
I don't even get what night, why is night swimming?
Because it's all la 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 la
la. It's a nice song. Hit stop, by the way.
But then you surprised me.
I always surprise you.
And I've determined that was Moxie Fruvus.
Fruvus, yes.
Moxie Fruvus.
Correct.
Canadian?
Yep.
Can Canadian people even hear this podcast? Like, I've been told that they don't, they like, iTunes doesn't have us in Canada. I think that's what I was told.
Look, we have,
we're unavailable something.
As I discovered from the dozens of emails that we received this week when we asked people to tell us how the audio was going. Thank you, by the way, to those of you who wrote in. We have listeners in Japan and Israel.
That doesn't mean Canada's going
to
get
it. Well, I think Canada can manage. Even if we're not in Canadian iTunes, they can go to the website and download it. They can friend us on Facebook and listen on our page.
Right.
I'm sure they have all manner of things. Even if we don't, maybe now that we are playing Moxie Fruvus, we will meet Canadian content requirements. You know.
You think?
Well, you know, if not, we'll just bring James Rocky or Malcolm Ingram back, or, you know, I don't know, something.
Malcolm wasn't officially a guest.
No.
He just wandered in at the last minute.
I think that counts, yeah, though. You're Dave White.
I'm Dave White. I'm from movies.com. I'm a super important film critic at movies.com.
Are there any super important film critics anymore?
Me.
Oh, okay.
I don't know about the rest of y'all.
Okay.
But me. I'm actually the president of the super important film critics club.
Uh-huh. The Hall of Justice?
I'm the only member at the moment, and I'm determining who I'm going to let in.
I see.
With me.
Gotcha.
But I haven't decided on who else is super important enough yet.
Apparently I'm not, and I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film critic for TheWrap.com.
You have a series of hazing rituals that you have to endure before you get inducted.
I don't want
to
be in your stupid
into club. Into the super important film critics.
I'm also on What the Flick on YouTube on the Young Turks Network. Pardon.
And we are, how many movies do we have that we're going to talk about?
Bunches.
The Amazing Spider-Man.
Yes.
Which is clearly why you played Moxie Fruvus.
Yes.
Just now. And
it opens on Tuesday, so we figured, what the heck, we'd go ahead and.
It opens on Tuesday because if we wait till like Sunday,
yeah,
then it's going to be.
You'll have all seen it by then.
Yeah, you'll be, and you won't have us to. I mean, it might be a better idea if we just wait.
because
then people will have seen it.
Yes, but
we won't be ruining it.
Well, we're not going to be all spoilery, and B, I've already played Moxie Fruvus, so we're committed at this point, frankly.
You're committed at this point.
You should be committed.
I'm the, what else is next after that? We've got People Like Us. We've got Magic Mike.
Right.
Ted.
Mm-hmm.
And
Medea's Witness Protection.
Medea's Witness Protection. All right. And we also have as you said before the timing started, we have a hard out.
Yes.
This week.
We have breakfast with lesbians.
We must finish like in an hour because we have to go pick up lesbians and take them to breakfast.
We can go an hour plus, but still, we need to keep it tight.
Right.
So what? That means we're not going to have some rambling subject that prevents us from getting to the movie.
One of them is an on-time lesbian. I know this for a fact. Mm-hmm. One of them is a not on-time lesbian.
Right.
So I assume we're going to have to like wait a little bit. Maybe she might be ready by the time we get her.
You never know.
Okay.
She could surprise us all.
They're not a couple of lesbians.
No.
I mean, there are a couple of lesbians, but they're not a couple.
They're two discreet, D-I-S-C-R-E-T-E lesbians.
And so, yeah, no, there will not be a 15-minute rambling discussion about
grape soda.
About grape soda this week. There might be one in the middle of
true. We can't help ourselves.
But there was not gonna. We're not gonna begin.
No.
With a 15-minute rambling discussion.
So all right, then let's get right into it. Let's talk about
Spider-Man.
The amazing Spider-Man, a movie that
is somewhat amazing.
Yeah. That no
I
one
mean,
that,
when I say somewhat. You go on. You liked it really a lot.
Yeah, I mean it's a movie that really nobody was clamoring for, I want to say.
Not me. I was unclamoring for it. I was anti-clamoring.
I was perfectly content to let that franchise, you know, go back into the pupil stage for a while and but it's here and it exists and we must deal with it. And it turns out pretty darn entertaining. I really liked it.
I had a really good time, and I think the mark of its goodness is that it made me forget that I was grumpy going in. Now the fact that when I got there at 9:30 on Friday morning for the screening,
right.
Not only did the AMC theater that we had to see it in have their cafe open, which is different from the concession stand.
Yes,
there are three-tiered theater
complex,
and so the top tier and the bottom tier are straight up concession stands, although pretty elaborate concession stands.
Yeah, they have pizza
with like
and chicken.
Chicken tenders and mozzarella sticks and those roast beef stuffed pretzels, and I wish they had those, but they
pheasant under glass.
It's just sort of a fantasy that I've always nurtured that there'd be the
roast beef stuffed pretzels.
Yeah.
It seems way too complicated.
Aaron came up with it, actually. Oh. He said pot roast stuffed pretzels. And the minute he said pot roast stuffed pretzels, my thoughts went to, when is that going to happen?
Would it come with like an au jus for dipping?
Yes. When will that happen for me? But no. So they had their cafe open, right? I'm sorry, the cafe.
And, Le cafe.
And they...
where the guy behind the counter moves like he's underwater.
Yeah, the chocolate muffin and the green hot green tea free on my stub, on my AMC Stubbs card.
Nice.
I had accumulated enough stub points. Cash.
Something.
Stub money.
Levi Stubbs.
Everything was free. All of it free. So that put me in a better mood
than
the idea of having to get up early to go see Spider-Man after having stayed up until 3 a.m. the night before watching Tyler Perry's Madea's Witness Protection.
Yeah, I was in a cranky
mood.
At
the same theater,
Yeah. Like, why did we leave?
We could have put sleeping bags down in their lobby and just hung out.
Yeah, I was in a crap mood, A, from the lack of sleep, and B, because we found out over the course of the week that almost everybody we know got into this Tuesday night screening.
Three days earlier. Everyone we know got into that
like,
one.
Like the Schmoes Know guys and Gray and Matt and Christy. And
every single human being that we know personally.
It was like, wow, this is a party we were not invited to, you know. And because of having to go on a Friday morning on the opening day of Madea, that necessitated the midnight movie and the not sleeping and the yada yada.
No, you know, in...
However, it once we got there and like, you know, Manola Dargis and Leonard Maltin and, Kenneth Turan were there.
Everybody else there.
So I think clearly we're on the list of like print people or something.
We're not print.
No, well,
we're internet.
I know, but I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what they're thinking. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know how this all went down, but anyway.
I think what they said was Dave White is the president of the super important Movie Critics Club. And we'll just put all the people, all the people that he's considering for membership in the
on Friday morning.
I'm sorry, friends, personal friends, who were at the Tuesday screening. You're not on my list. None of y'all.
Well, I was glad that those guys at least finally showed up.
I regret to inform.
Because when we got there early, the mass that was gathering outside and then all the people that came in with us were like,
goons.
Who are these people? I mean,
the lady who shoved her way in and said, I got a bad leg.
Ankle.
No, she said, I got a bad leg. And that's exactly how she said, I got a bad leg. And she's like pushing and everything. And I've seen her at screenings a lot. And she's like this little short little woman with a wallet chain.
Oh, wow.
and she sits down front. She gets her way.
Gotcha.
Like, you don't, you, she, it, I'm,
you step three, aside.
I'm three times her size. And she's just like, move it, buddy.
Anyway, all
Spider-Man,
that
Spider-Man.
All that aside, was Spider-Man fun. Was really
yeah. After all
was
that
quite
being,
entertaining.
I was super grumpy going in. Then I got my free tea. Then I got my free muffin. And then the movie turned out to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They basically, you know, they have to start over. They have to do another origin story. But they kind of mix it up a little. I mean, I'm not super versed in the comics, but I have to say this is the first Spider-Man origin story I've ever seen.
It was a lip smack right there. Then. There. Sounded like you were trying to kiss me.
Yes, well, I'm testing my new mouthwash. It was the first Spider-Man origin story that I'd ever seen that that acknowledges Peter Parker's parents. Like, no one ever talks about his actual parents. He just, right. you know, he grew up with his Aunt May and his Uncle Ben, you know, foundling or something, you know.
Right. I've never read any of the comics except for Peter Baggs, the megalomaniacal Spider-Man.
Yes, which if you can get your hands on, it's pretty hilarious.
And I have never thought about him as ever having parents. I mean, I know enough to know Aunt May.
Right.
And Uncle
Ben.
Ben.
And you also know that when a man and a woman love each other very much,
the stork brings them a baby.
Into their cabbage patch.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're part of the story, and it, you know, his father was a scientist who was working for Oscorp,
right?
Owned by Harry Osborn, which is not addressed much here, but I guess is sort of waiting to pop up later. Who, you know, he's sort of like the mysterious, you know, the guy who runs the company in Prometheus, basically. He's sort of like this
right.
shadowy rich guy.
Right.
Anyway. So this Peter Parker, a little less nerdy than other ones, but he's still supposed to be sort of an outsider. But he looks like Andrew Garfield. No high school student who looked like Andrew Garfield was ever an outsider.
Same with Emma Stone.
Right. Well, she's at least sort of popular, but she's still like science girl on the debate team.
She's a science nerd on the debate team.
Who wears mini skirts and thigh-high boots.
Which leads me to the poster for The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which comes out in September. I don't want to see this movie.
Well,
I'm sure the book is really nice. I don't want to see this movie because you know what? None of those teen models on the poster are? Wallflowers. You know what they have never been? Wallflowers. Do you know what happens to kids who look like that in high school? They're not wallflowers at all.
Just an aside, let's keep talking about Spider-Man. I'm willing to give it a shot. We'll see what happens.
All right.
So it turns out that Peter's father had worked with a scientist named Dr. Curtis Connors, played by Rhys Ifans.
Yes.
Who is missing.
Ifans or Ifans?
Maybe it's Ifans.
Whatever. Okay.
However the Welsh say it. He is missing an arm and has long been working on these sort of human-animal genetic crossbreeds because basically he wants to be able to give himself the reptile's ability to regrow missing limbs.
Wouldn't it be great if he could have just grown a full crocodile on his arm? And he would just be the guy with the crocodile arm. No one would mess with him.
It'd be kind of awkward at parties, though.
No, it'd be awesome at parties. He'd say, look what my crocodile arm can do.
Right, but, you know, like they'd come around with a tray of canapes, you know.
And he just chomps what he wants.
Like, oh, I'm so sorry, it's my crocodile. Forgive me, everyone, I have a crocodile for a hand. So sorry.
That's what I was thinking while I was watching the movie. It would just be great if he could just grow a crocodile and not turn into a lizard himself.
And I guess that's why you're a super important film critic, because this is the stuff you think of during movies. So, you know, Peter gets bitten and becomes Spider-Man, and Dr. Connors injects himself with lizard things and becomes the Lizard, and they
in a lab coat.
In a lab coat. That's I showed you in the comics.
I know, the comic lab coat is a thing. I know, it's great. I like that he wore the coat.
Yeah.
The coat didn't, you know.
And they battle in Manhattan, and the flying, the web flying sequence, the swinging sequences are extraordinary.
Is worth the 3D.
Worth the IMAX.
I don't get excited about this kind of thing very often, but it was exciting to watch him swoop.
You used a word in your review that I wish I had thought of for mine, which was giddy.
Yeah. I became giddy.
Yeah. And I have to say, I got a little I was kind of moved toward the end.
By the swooping?
Not by the swooping. There's a sequence where like it's towards the end, and Spider-Man gets injured, and other people kind of come to his assistance in a way that I found really much even more moving than that subway scene in Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi one.
I like the subway scene in number two better.
I liked this one better. Yeah. Generally speaking, in fact, I think I liked this one better than I liked any of the Raimi movies.
Really?
Yeah, but I was not the biggest fan of the Raimi movies, so take that with the requisite grain of salt. I also like the fact that Gwen actually plays a key role in beating the bad guy. She's not just
Kirsten
the
Dunst
girl.
Is a little passive.
Yeah,
as Gwen.
No, she's Mary. She's Mary Jane.
Mary Jane, and whatever. And the look.
Direct your angry emails to him.
The girl.
That's the thing. Gwen winds up not just being the girl in this one.
Right.
Yeah. You know, she helps.
Yeah. So.
I'm in for Spider-Man 2.0. I'm in for the new franchise. Bring them.
Yeah.
And apparently the sequel is already set for 2014. So.
All right.
So yeah, go see it.
I agree.
We do not, however, agree on Magic Mike. Why don't you talk about it?
I got something I got to look up here on the thing. Yeah.
All right, so Channing Tatum plays Mike, who is fancies himself an entrepreneur. He does construction jobs. He has an auto detailing business. He's supposedly a furniture designer, but his real source of income is stripping and shaking his groove thing as part of an all-male review.
You like the expression groove thing. I think you used it in your review too.
Well, there's only
groove thing.
Well, there aren't a lot
like your peaches and herb.
There aren't a lot of
a
lot of synonyms for stripping. You know, I don't want to say that word over and over again.
I guess you're right.
You know, it's
exotic dancing.
Exotic dancing, and he went on a construction job. He meets recent college dropout
Diablo Codying. That's what you could call it.
But that could be so many things.
Diablo Cody's all over that stage.
That could be, you know, like writing an irritating screenplay peppered with clumsy pop culture references.
You be nice to Diablo Cody. She's nice, I guess.
We think. I don't know her. Anyway, so he meets Alex Pettifer and kind of brings him in, takes him under his wing and brings him into the world of male stripping. And, you know, Alex Pettifer starts taking a lot of drugs, and Channing Tatum keeps trying to like get a loan and, you know, up his station in life and sort of change his destiny, but he's sort of trapped by economic circumstances and I was not into this movie, and I know I'm in the minority here, but to me it felt like it rehashed so many plot elements from the 1981 TV movie For Ladies Only.
Doesn't matter.
It was insane. Well, and not just from that, but in general, sort of these kind of showbiz cliches about, you know, people who are doing something sordid and want to get out, or they succumb to the darker aspects of the lifestyle.
I don't even think that was the point of the movie.
Well, that's what I got out of it. And, you know, there are some good performances in it. I like Channing Tatum. I like Matthew McConaughey as the guy who runs the strip club. I liked Cody Horn, who I didn't realize when I was watching it, as the daughter of the president of Warner Brothers, as the love interest and Alex Pettifer's sister. I like the fact that he sort of filmed, that Steven Soderbergh films the whole, all of the sunny Florida through the mustard filter and makes it all kind of gray and washed out. But I was bored. and I didn't care about the characters for the most part, and I thought that the situations were trite, and if he was trying to make some big point about the fantasy industry versus the hellish reality of today's terrible economy, I thought he did that better in The Girlfriend Experience. That's what I thought. And I didn't think the stripping sequences were very good. If that's what they're selling this movie like, woo, ladies, come watch them shake their thing. They're kind of not all that well done, and not even well done as a commentary on how bad male stripping is. Okay, go.
You're done.
Yeah.
You're done being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
All right, here I'm fixing to be right.
Yes, super important. Lay it on us.
Setting aside the marketing. Well, actually, we can't set aside the marketing for a second, because the marketing determined, unfortunately, one of the larger problems going on with this film is it's going to be a long time before people can look at this movie and see it for what it is, because the marketing was so powerful and so effective. Because I have now spent the weekend listening to or reading, you know, Facebook posts from people who've been to theaters to see it this weekend, where it's been a jamboree.
Yeah.
In those theaters,
Lady Palooza,
like in the theaters full of nothing but women and a half a dozen gay dudes. Shrieking, like yelling and screaming every time a shirtless or a shirtless man or some dude's buttocks prance across the screen.
Right.
That's fine if you want to get all, you know, tanked up on Cosmos or whatever and go see this movie and treat it like a thing that it is not. By all means.
That is the sizzle of this movie.
Have a good time, you know. But I think that when you do that, I think you're going to have to be drunk, because if that's all you've come for,
you're going to be disappointed.
You're going to be disappointed. You're going to be bored. And that's not, unfortunately, did you ever see the words, a film by Steven Soderbergh in any of these, in the big glitzy, you know, pectoral ads?
The commercials? Never.
No, it's not like, and so... When you watch the stripping scenes,
and for that matter, they advertise is the presence of Joe Manganiello and Matt Bomer, who between them have like six lines.
Right. When you watch the stripping scenes, what I found fascinating about them, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with them. I think they were interesting in that you get to first of all see what a really good dancer Channing Tatum is, because the other guys. Or like his backup crew, in a way. Like, the other guys are just sort of, like, going through the motions. They might as well be S Club 7 standing behind him, you know, doing these sort of, like,
Well, there's a more sort of costume-based fantasy moves.
But his dancing is, like, well, it's like in the Step Up movies. It's all over the place. Like, you don't even care. I didn't care. I didn't even care if he's going to take much clothing off anyway. Because you're just like, wow, dude, you're like a really good dancer.
Was the first Step Up movie, is that the first thing we ever saw him in?
That's the first thing I ever saw him in.
Yeah.
And so what's fascinating to me about the stripping scenes is that they get truncated really quickly. Like, in one instance... Like, this big banner unfurls in front of them just as they're about to, like, really expose themselves.
Right.
And then there's a cut to... Because the film is separated into months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, June, July, August. It's, like, a summer is what it takes place. It takes place over the course of a summer in Tampa. Well, there's one edit that they're at the height of their stripping move, and the screen goes black, like, boom! And it says, August. And it made the audience laugh, but they do that a lot. He does that a lot in the movie. He edits quickly and cuts things and pulls away or abruptly turns off the stripping right when you are getting your woo on.
It's like how in Girlfriend Experience, where you think, oh, he's a porn actress in this movie, and it's the least sexy thing ever.
Which I believe is, again, part of the point of this film is that there's tease, 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 you're done. And I think that parallels the plot in a way that there is the promise in the United States of mobility, financial and economic, you know, and social man. Mobility.
Go ahead.
Are you going to let me do my talking?
You're going to make
us. Are you going to let me be super important film critic right now? I'm fixing to be.
You better take a deep breath before you make this stretch, yoga boy.
No, I'm not. I'm this is no stretch. This is no stretch. This is form mirroring.
Okay.
This is form as the thing itself. Okay.
Go on.
This is a movie constructed as a tease. And the theme of the movie is not anything related to stripping or Hollywood or not Hollywood, but show business. That's not what the movie's about. The movie's not about that. The movie is about a carrot dangling in front of you that you will never grasp. You will never catch it. You will never get the thing you want. You're not going to get Joe Manganiello's big prosthetic Boogie Nights penis in your face in this film. I mean, you do kind of, but you're not going, you're really not going to. And these characters, specifically Channing Tatum, he's not going to get what he wants. He is stymied by all the forces outside of that little club where he is the king. Every time he steps out into the world, nothing good happens to him. And it's partially his own fault. He doesn't pursue the thing that he wants with a serious amount of drive. He likes to party a little too much, you know. But what does happen to him is that the banks and the economy and circumstance and everything that would normally get in your way that you might be able to overcome, because the world is so dominated now by people that are 1,000 times bigger than you and 1,000 times more powerful, you're doomed. Like, you're not getting anywhere. And the point of this movie is it's about work, and it's about the failure of working hard and getting ahead, how you just can't do that right now, at least right now, maybe not forever now. We might have already turned the corner into becoming a country where you're never getting ahead, no matter how hard you try. And there's a reason why these strippers in their downtime are sitting around talking about, if I had a kid, I'd make him watch Mad Money every day of his life. And then there's this girl stripper who's like, yeah, I just went to the last Rich Dad, Poor Dad seminar. And when they say these things, it's meant to be this sort of like Robert Altman, sort of like chattery, 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 chattery. But that's all the chatter there is. And that's why this movie is about something completely other than stripping. It's smart. It's definitely pointed, but you have to be paying attention to that. If you direct your attention to the stripping, not only will you be somewhat disappointed, but you're going to be bored through a lot of the rest of the movie, because that's not what the film is about.
But here's the thing. I got what the film was about, and I was following all that, and I was still bored. Like, it may do that. It may have other ambitions besides...
And it does it very well.
Besides stripping, but no, I disagree. I don't think it does it very well. I think that it still flattens everything out. It doesn't say anything new. I just found it unengaging.
It's not new, but it's definitely now.
I think The Girlfriend Experience is a better movie about the same topic. And I think that once you take that out of it, it's just not engaging. I'm sorry. I just didn't go for it. And I got what you got out of it. And I understood the subtext and all that stuff, but it didn't make the movie any better.
Wrong. Moving on. Ted.
Fool. Ted. I don't like the Family Guy.
No, you don't.
If somebody sends me a 30-second clip of Family Guy on YouTube, I'll watch it. Ha-ha. But yeah, an entire episode, can't do it. I laughed a lot at this. It is not... I like Family Guy. It did peaks and valleys, and there are times where you wish it would get funny again, and other stuff happens. But when it's funny, it is... one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time.
Like, yeah, this is gut buster.
Like, there was one scene where I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was so not breathing and just shaking.
That is definitely one of the handful of funniest scenes in the movie, the one that you're talking about. Yeah. It involves a scatological event.
Yes.
And but what's that's funny, all I'm going to say.
What's funny about that scene, though, it's not so much the gross out. It's Mark Wahlberg reacting to it like a child. Because, you know, the premise of the film is that, you know, as a young boy, he makes a wish that his teddy bear could come to life and be his friend. And he does. And as such, 30 years later, you know, Mark Wahlberg is still very much this kind of, you know, man-child, still hanging around with Ted the teddy bear, who's voiced by Seth MacFarlane, a Family Guy who co-wrote and directed the film. And I remember before, before seeing the film, somebody said, well, how is a talking teddy bear supposed to exist in the world? Like, are they going to even address that? And they do, at the very beginning.
Yeah,
because we're basically, you know, word gets out about it. Ted becomes a sort of minor celebrity. And he's, you know, they put him in a clip where he's on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. And then he's a has-been. Nobody cares anymore. So he's just sort of like hanging out with
Kind of like the Adam Sandler character in That's My Boy.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I did think about That's My Boy in terms of this because this movie sort of reaffirmed my faith in tasteless comedy. Because it does it well.
It's a way better movie than That's My Boy. That's My Boy is indefensible. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ever defend it when I was enjoying myself so much. I want that to be made perfectly clear.
You're still going to movie hell.
But this is a much better movie.
Yes.
Than That's My Boy. This is it's funny, it's smart. They employ it. I heard that the thing, the extended cameo, was meant to be some sort of spoiler, even though EW did a whole article about this.
I was going to say, I've seen whole articles. I avoided mentioning it in my review just in case.
I didn't. I mentioned it. I mentioned him. I said it in my review, who's in it and what happens and he does, all that stuff.
You probably already know, but if you don't, we're not going to tell you. But yeah, there's a reference. You know, at first, the film is referenced. It's a sort of cheesy 80s sci-fi movie. And you think it's going to be kind of a throwaway gag, and then it comes up again, and then it becomes a major sort of, you know, recurring thing in the film.
Here's the thing. Now, this apparently people are saying, telling now I'm the one in trouble because I said the spoiler. Well, last week it was you in trouble for saying the spoiler about Brave.
Right.
When neither one of these things felt like they were meant to be spoilers at all.
No, and they're
like,
not. And again, they
the
come
movie
up,
doesn't treat them as big reveals.
No, they come up early and happen for an extended period, so they're plot developments, yeah. You know. But whatever, I don't want to deal with that anymore, so I'm not going to talk about
it. Sick of people telling me what to say and what not to say.
We should get all Popcorn Mafia and be like, look, there's going to be spoilers.
Right.
There's also a scene in which, you know, sort of, this is the most kind of like snakehead eating its own tail kind of pop culture parody I've seen in a while, where they make fun of a scene, a famous scene in a movie that is famous for, in turn, making fun of another famous scene in another movie. Famous movie.
One thing I really appreciated about this film is the way that it takes the Judd Apatow template of this guy has to grow up,
right,
and takes it to its crazy literal
extreme. Yeah, because it's not like, I don't want to get rid of my, you know, my Mego Justice League action figures. It's like, no, my actual teddy bear is still here and smoking pot with me on the sofa.
And it's alive.
Yeah.
These things that are metaphors in the other film is a living, breathing thing in this movie. And it won't let go of you.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, even if you wanted to get rid of it,
It's got a hold on
you. It's got a hold on you. And I think my only beef, and I've had a disagreement with some people about this who saw it completely differently. Mm-hmm. My only beef with the film is that I don't think they used Mila Kunis the right way.
No, and I think this movie generally has a woman problem.
Yeah.
Because Mila Kunis gets saddled with the mostly thankful role. And she's not this 100%, but she is the one who's sort of stuck being the naggy girlfriend who wants him to, like, you know, grow up and move on and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, she has her own mitigating factors. But the thing is,
like, the Katherine Heigl character in Knocked Up is more chill than the Mila Kunis character.
I think so,
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, she is the only, literally the only woman in the movie who is not a whore.
Well, there's Ted's girlfriend. She's
a whore.
She's white trash, but she's not a prostitute.
Well, she's not every literally other... a prostitute, but she is like inappropriate and tacky and like, you know, having sex with a teddy bear.
Right.
So she might as well be. She's close cousin to a whore. And then the rest are actual whores.
Actual prostitutes.
Yes.
Like those are the other female characters in the film.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just wanted, you know, I didn't mind that she was the voice of "You Gotta Grow Up." I just wanted her to be a cooler, funnier voice of "You Gotta Grow Up." Now, she does have some funny moments.
Definitely.
In the film, but it isn't because of her character. It's because of how her character reacts to some things.
Right.
And that's, I was bothered by that. I think Seth MacFarlane is smarter than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's capable of being more awesome than that. And I think this was a poorly constructed character.
Yeah. And I think that the movie's pacing is kind of all over the place because it kind of goes off in these tangents. Like there's this whole thing with Giovanni Ribisi as this sort of obsessed stalker.
I loved Giovanni Ribisi.
And he, you know, he's got some great moments. He has a dance sequence that will burn itself into your memory.
When he dances, it's as good or better than anything you'll see in Magic Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Silence of the Lambs. But it all feels so like we have to do this or we don't have a third act, you know?
Yeah, the it has to slow down and teach you a lesson about friendship.
Yeah.
Which I also...
And there has to be like an action sequence.
I think, you know? I dislike that more than I dislike the Mila Kunis character. I don't want things to slow down. I never want things to slow down. If you have a comedy that is essentially mayhem,
right?
I want the mayhem to keep going. If you're going to teach me something, contextualize it within the frenzy of everything else.
Like, well, you know? Yeah, this will be an odd movie to cite, but I always remember that in Wayne's World,
yeah,
you know, there is the requisite, like, gotta get Tia Carrere conflict back just to have some sort of, like, third act thing. And I just remember thinking, like, I could even tell that the movie knew that we didn't care,
right,
but that they had to do it. And they did it in a way where they kept it funny and they kept it odd and, you know, in keeping with the rest of the film so that we could all sort of get through it together, you know?
Right.
And with Ted, it just sort of feels like, okay, we have to do this thing now and then it'll be over and, you know.
Right. Right.
But again, when it's
extremely funny,
when it's funny, it's so very
extremely
funny.
Absolutely forgivable. All that other stuff, I forgive it.
Yeah,
because it's that dang funny.
It's a movie that, like, I'm sure 9-year-olds everywhere will be sneaking their parents' DVD, you know, out and like quoting for the rest of their lives.
Oh no! What they're gonna do is they're gonna get it. Whatever friend of theirs is smart enough to steal it from the internet.
That's right.
They're gonna get it that way.
Yeah.
Because this is the kind of movie that kids. The taboo factor of this is gonna be such that 10 and 11 and 12 year olds are going to kill each other trying to get to see this movie.
Because this movie is the comedy is
dirty, filthy. dirty movie. The kind of dirty that when you're that age, you're like, I have to know what's going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like your curiosity is burning you inside to know what the adults are laughing at that you're not allowed to see.
Yes.
That's how I felt when I was little about R-rated movies.
Right.
When I was, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, and then the breaking point was 12 because I was like, come on, all my other friends have seen R-rated movies by this point, you know?
Yes.
And then my dad finally took me to see an R-rated movie when I was 12. Yeah. Undercover's Hero, starring Peter Sellers. So many boobs. So many boobs. 2 weeks later, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. A film I did not understand.
I saw
Cuckoo's
Nest.
I was still happy I got to go see it.
In the theater, too, because I think they couldn't get a sitter or something. I remember about, like, I think I was 12 when I sort of browbeat my brother and sister into taking me to see The World According to Garp because I'd already read the book, and I was like, oh, come on.
Right. Right.
What else this week? Medea.
Medea. Medea.
Now, we are not haters.
I'm a fan.
We do not
I'm
reject.
A Medea fan. I have evolved into becoming an... I've evolved into fandom for Medea. I didn't get her right from the at first. Like, Diary of a Mad Black Woman, I thought, A, this movie is terrible. B, who is this dude? What
dress.
Is going on with this? Like, I didn't have any context for him, and I didn't know the history of the plays. I mean, it took me a couple movies to catch up to the Medea phenomenon.
Right.
But once I did, I was like, okay, I get it. You are as I said in my review this week, you are Red Fox and LaWanda Page combined from Sanford and Son. Also, you are Popeye and the Tasmanian Devil. Like, all four of those things in one human being. I'll sit back and enjoy you now.
Yeah, so we are not some clueless white film critics who have never seen these movies.
We're clueless white film critics.
And, well, but I'm just saying, I think there are so many people that we know who've never seen a Tyler Perry movie, like working film critics who somehow managed to not see these movies.
Well, because Leonard Maltin gets to send his daughter to whatever he doesn't want to go see. Hey, Jesse.
And so, you know, you've seen all of them, and I've seen most of them.
Yes. And again, Tyler Perry's films are not good. Generally, they're not good films. They're often awful films. But when Madea shows up in the middle of a terribly constructed melodrama and starts banging people on the head with a frying pan or shooting at people or crashing cars into buildings and yelling at people and teaching them things, that's fantastic.
She will make a movie work for the moments that she appears.
Yes.
And this movie, I'm just guessing. I haven't read any interviews or anything, but it appears like it's his attempt to cross over, if you will, you know, to white audiences. There's more white people in this movie with major speaking roles than probably any Tyler Perry movie to date, except maybe The Family That Prays. Yeah. And it's terrible.
Yeah, I'm extremely disappointed.
Even
by this.
Like by Madea standards, by Tyler Perry standards, this is a terrible movie. And because mainly because Madea is ill used, I think.
My entire review and my tagline was "When is Madea not Madea?" Mm-hmm. And Madea is not Madea in this film. Only in the final credits where you see Tyler Perry improving in a Borat kind of way
with unsuspecting hotel staff.
I
will say the first few scenes worth of Madea, like her first appearance where she, you know, where Romeo tries to mug her, and like the scene, the first couple scenes in the house, it's Madea classic. It is, she is being tough and funny.
But still more subdued than before.
But I didn't notice right away that she was still enough in the zone.
It all felt completely off to me. There was like, his head is not in the game in this movie at all. He didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be making it. I think he had a few ideas for some funny scenes and then decided he had to figure out a way to construct a movie around it. I think he was busy with Alex Cross. I think he had some sort of contractual obligation to get this thing done at a certain amount of time.
It does feel tossed off. And even the scenes that you're waiting for that you think are going to be the big payoff sequences to make the rest of this movie, you know, worthwhile, don't really go anywhere. Like, you know, where Madea goes through airport security for the first time, there's like a lot of opportunities there for wackiness that aren't really pursued. The premise of the movie is that Eugene Levy is this corporate accountant, and he finds out that his company has been doing like a Ponzi scheme and laundering money for the mob, and so he has to go into witness protection, so they put him in Madea's house. So he's got this awful bratty teenage daughter, and that's the perfect character for Madea to like take down about 10 pegs.
More than that, to physically beat.
That too. And I don't know if he thought...
This is a character that has abused children on screen.
Yeah, smacked him in the head.
Comedic child abuse on the part of this character.
Yeah.
In other films.
And so I don't know if Tyler Perry's thinking was like, oh, white audiences are not going to go for this old black lady.
I don't think he thought that at all.
Smacking this white girl.
I don't think he thought. And here's why I don't think he thought.
But if he didn't think, then why didn't he just go through the motions of what Madea's done before rather
because
than...
Because he's bored. Because he's bored. And my ideas have been validated. My ideas have been validated by a thing that I read yesterday that I want to direct everybody to.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Movie Line, and it's an interview with him.
Oh, okay.
Jen Yamato, my fellow, my former
Movies.com
critic, who now is the West Coast editor for Movie Line. She interviewed him. Mm-hmm. She sat down with him for an interview. Might have been a phone or might have been a junket thing, whatever. And she laid down some incredibly complex questions for him about what this character's doing, who he's doing it to, who Madea is doing things to, why this film exists, the themes of this film. And Jen Yamato is doing her job in this interview. Like, thinking, asking all the important questions.
So she got to see it early then.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he had no answers for her.
Ooh.
None. He even says, here are some examples of answers that he gives her. Brackets, laughs. You're trying to make it seem like I'm so smart, and I did not even think about that. Wow, down the page, another answer. Wow, again, I wasn't thinking that either. Hang on.
So she put more effort into this movie than he did.
Yes. Okay. Jen Yamato thought more about Madea's witness protection than Tyler Perry thought about Madea's witness protection. That is a problem. This is coming on the heels, by the way, of Madea's Big Happy Family.
Which is the best Madea
the
movie.
The best one. The funniest one. The one that made me think, all right, I'm stoked. I can't wait to see Madea's witness protection because Madea's Big Happy Family, genuinely, hilariously funny.
Yeah.
Like, I laughed from start to finish.
I mean, it's still sloppy in that Tyler Perry way, but
right.
It's a lot of fun.
But it's fun. It's really funny. And because that was the one that came before this one, I thought, all right, this one's going to be great. Because the goal of a franchise, of an ongoing franchise, and this is like the seventh movie with Madea, is take what you had, amp it up. Take what you had, amp it up. Now, unfortunately, Madea has been moving in the opposite direction in general.
Right.
Less violent, no weed smoking anymore. But in Madea's Big Happy Family, she kind of goes for it. And here, it's like, nah, I'm tired. I'm tired of doing this. I'm tired of it. I'm gonna make you not want to watch me do this anymore by making this the most boring and inept of all the Madea movies. Makes me sad.
Yeah.
Go to movieline.com, read Jen Yamato's interview with Tyler Perry, and watch her expose him as not having done any work on this film at all.
Do you think it's intentional sabotage on his part, or
probably?
Just...
I think he even says in the interview that he's tired of being the character, that he wants to retire the character, and that he hates being in the makeup, hates being in the dress, wants to get it all knocked out in a couple days so he doesn't have to do it very much. And so this is, I think that now that he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and now he's a giant bazillionaire, I think Madea turns into sort of a tell for him. Like, Madea is a part of his personality that I think he doesn't want out in the public anymore. I think that his own self, his own ideas about himself are such that he wants, you know, to present more of a mainstream sort of dude,
right,
to the world, instead of this playwright that can on a dime turn into
sassy old lady. Well, you know, it's funny because, like, you know, when comedians want to get more serious and talk about, oh, I don't want to put on the clown suit again, he literally has a clown suit.
He literally has a clown suit. Right. But it's more than a clown suit. It's a female clown suit.
Sure.
And I think his discomfort is palpable. Great.
But yeah. Here's the thing. Without Madea,
his movies are boring.
Well, and not only that, they don't make money. Good Deeds and, like, those movies.
Which was probably the most competently directed film he's ever created.
Yeah, I think perhaps his lowest grossing film as well.
Really?
I have to look it up. But, I mean, like, you know, Daddy's Little Girls, the Madea-less Tyler Perry movies are not nearly the hits that the Madea movies are.
Right.
So he is shooting himself in the foot if he thinks that he's going to get away from that.
Yeah. Weird.
And oh, that Alex Cross trailer.
Oh, man, I can't wait. Cannot wait to see him try to be a badass.
That is such a studio accountant thing of, like, I have this piece of paper that says that this guy's movies rake in this much money. Let's put him in this action film, you know.
That's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
I saw People Like Us. You did not.
No. Oh, and we have to take this waltz, too. Let's not forget.
Okay, well, we could, you know what? We don't have a lot of time, so we might push that for next week because it's...
Okay, it's on demand.
It's on demand and it's in limited slowly. Release, yeah.
All right, next week we'll talk about Sarah Polley's new film, Take This Waltz. People like us, what's the deal?
I feel bad right now, a little bad, because, you know, I don't consider many publicists, you know, friends. But I know that I have a really nice working relationship with one of the Disney publicists.
Look, they didn't make the movie. They're just selling it.
I know, but it,
that you're talking about this, it is all means that their job is done.
This Disney publicist really loves this movie and is like really behind this movie. Oh. And so I feel kind of double bad because it's like...
When you start coming with the customer, it's time to quit.
I know. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, dude. Do I not like this movie. And he's really into it. And so, and I can see why they really want to push a movie like this, because it's in the middle of summer. Mm-hmm. They are dropping a family drama.
Right.
You know.
From the studio that brought you The Help.
Right. In the middle of summer, they're positioning a family drama as some sort of counter programming to like Spider-Man or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or Ted. I mean, obviously, the chances are of you liking this are in direct, you know, correlation to you disliking Ted.
It's the anti-Ted.
It stars Chris Pine and Elizabeth Banks and Michelle Pfeiffer. Those are the three big names. Chris Pine comes home to Los Angeles. He lives in New York. He comes home to Los Angeles with his girlfriend, played by Olivia Wilde. And he has to settle his father's estate. And he learns that his father has left him a bag. Inside the bag is $150,000 in cash. Now, his dad was a very successful record producer in Los Angeles, knows all the famous bands, knows all the famous people, and consequently was a terrible father because he was always out, you know, scouting bands, hanging with the bands, partying with the bands, hanging out with the ladies. And
Rodney Bingenheimer.
And Rodney Bingenheimer. And not home with his wife and kid. Mm-hmm. We think that somehow this, along with the estrangement that developed between Chris Pine and the father, is also what has caused an estrangement between Chris Pine and his mother, Michelle Pfeiffer. And so... he comes home, he's going to settle the estate, he discovers that there's a bag, it's got 150 grand in it, and a note that says, bring this to this address, and then take care of these people. He brings it to the address, he realizes that the address is a woman about his age, Elizabeth Banks, and her son. And she is a single mom struggling to make ends meet, and the kid gets in trouble at school because the mom's not around because she's working so much to, you know, blah, 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 all that stuff. And so Chris Pine sort of insinuates himself into their lives secretly when he realizes that this is his sister.
Half.
And his nephew. And that there was a mistress who had a baby that was Elizabeth Banks.
Right.
And that...
the father has another family.
He's had another family. And he spent a little amount of time in their lives and then abandoned them. Completely. And reasons why become clear later in the film. And so, but here's the problem with the movie. It doesn't have enough going on to just direct this information immediately to Elizabeth Banks. The whole film is Chris Pine maneuvering around them, figuring out the right moment to drop the bomb. By the way, I'm your brother. By the way, here's $150,000. The only thing that keeps that an interesting plot development is that Elizabeth Banks is shown to be increasingly angry over the fact that she was abandoned by her father. And so much so angry that when the bomb finally drops, she goes ballistic. But here's the thing. This is from a guy named Alex Kurtzman, who pretty much has built his career as a writer for Alias, Fringe. He wrote
Transformers,
two of the Transformers movies. Star Trek movie. He wrote Cowboys and Aliens. He's a big screenwriter
right.
for big genre kind of films. And the
but he really wants to make this intimate family drama.
It says at the beginning is based on a true story. So this is clearly his story in some way. This is obviously a thing that has happened to him on some level. Like something happened.
Or to someone close to him.
Or to someone close to him. This is a personal movie. But it is pounded. The life is pounded out of it by the insistence on making it a sort of like, what will happen? What will happen? What will happen? What will happen? When he tells her, when he tells her, when he tells her. And that's not the kind of movie this is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be like an action suspense thriller, you know.
And then the robots show up. Oh, no, wait, I can't do that.
Yeah. I figure they probably spent 30 or 40 million on this. Maybe 25 or 30 million. Let's say they spent 30 million. That's a low budget movie by big studio standards. Right. For a film that you're going to put into 2,000 theaters.
Yeah, with stars in it.
With stars in it. That's your low budget kind of movie. It should have been made for about $5 million with people who were, you know, like.
With Catherine Keener.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because to have those kind of expectations. And to have the kind of film industry experience that he has, and he knows how to make a movie that amps up, you know, tension and stuff. I want, if you're going to show me a movie about real people.
Does the money have a big clock with big red LED numbers counting down that he has to give it to her by a certain time?
Or Los Angeles explodes. No. I've seen movies about real people in real human drama situations. And the thing that kills those kind of movies for me faster than anything is fakiness. Mm. I don't want there to be fakiness. And I don't want there to be a big giant third act.
Reveal
about the secret motivations of this person and the, oh, look what we found, this piece of evidence that means this other very incredibly moving thing that's about to make you cry real hard.
Ugh.
I hate that. I hate stepmom. and that's what this is.
Boo.
Having said that, they dig that knife in at the end. So that when the big thing happens at the end, mm-hmm. you're like, oh. Like, I sat there in the movie going, and then here at the end comes the thing at the end, and I went, oh, that's so sad. Like, for like 30 seconds, I was like, oh, I might get all choked up now. And then I was so angry that the movie could do that to me. So it's a thing that is a big problem. It ain't good. Elizabeth Banks is great. She is desperate in this film and angry in a great way. Her performance is better than the movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, good for her.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Couple of, for those of you who are not already sick of our voices, we did quite a few podcasts this week.
When can that ever happen?
Well, you never
know. Who's sick of our voices?
If somehow this all wasn't enough for you.
Baby, don't get sick of my voice. You know we love you.
Let me point you towards two shows that were kind enough to have us on this week. The Seventh Row Center podcast had us on, and we talked about sort of a brief history of gays in movies. And the B-Movies podcast, Bibbs and Whitney had us on again.
Did you just say the name of the podcast that we were on?
Seventh Row Center.
Yeah. Okay.
And the B-Movie podcast had us on, and we spoke with Bibbs and Whitney about our favorite films of 2012 to date. Dave's were all very...
Amazing.
Fancy. I don't think any of the...
As a member of the super important...
I don't think any club. Of the films you picked have showed on more than 5 screens at a time in this country.
Is that my fault?
I'm just saying. No. And we also talked about some of this week's new movies, and hopefully we didn't say all the same stuff on both shows.
We didn't.
Do we have time to do mail or no?
Yeah, hang on.
Okay. And did you watch another 15 minutes of Playmate of the Apes this week?
Or
did
I forgot.
Did you forget?
I forgot. I'll do it next week. Who cares?
Oh, people are... They're only tuning in for that. Well, next week you have to watch Half an Hour.
for a thing here. Hold on. There are so many. We are now in a letter glut. Not that we want you to stop.
No, no, by all means.
We're going to have to actually cut short the podcast itself to ever catch up on the letters, because we now have like 30 letters waiting in a queue to be. We might have to triage some of these. You might not get your letter. No, you're going to get your letter read if it's worth reading.
If it's the last thing we do, we're going to read your top 10 list and be judgy about it.
Hang on. I'm having a problem.
Oh, God. I
had them all queued up here, and I'm going to. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Here we go. Just relax.
I was going to have to hit pause. I don't like doing that.
James in London, the first person who's the top 10 we read.
Yes.
He said, I'm amazed that my 10 choices didn't get more ribbing. He goes, I need to clarify. They weren't necessarily the films I deemed the top 10 best, but they are the 10 films I can watch over and over again all the time and always enjoy. He goes, fear not. I know Romy and Michelle isn't an artistic triumph. Well, we think it is. And anyway, he says, I just heard you guys talking about Bella Me, the Robert Pattinson film. Don't know if it's a thing stateside or not, but the gay community here was chuckling, rather, when it came out. As in Europe, there's a big line of gay porn called Bella Me.
Yes, we knew that. It's big here, too. I guess we didn't mention it. Yeah, that's why my joke for the longest time is that I'm sure some Robert Pattinson, you know, fan was Googling Bella Me and...
That's funny.
And the character that the lead character in the novel and who Pattinson plays, Georges Duroy, is the name that the original director of the Bella Me movies used as his screen name.
Right.
So...
I just... You know, every time I hit delete on an email, it takes me back to the beginning of my thing. So, hang on. Here we go. Oh, man. Here's another one. Hang on. Here's another one. Adam. I really enjoyed this week's episode. I like the longer episodes. I could easily listen to Dave describe his scone for 45 minutes.
Don't encourage him.
Next week, I'm going to describe scones and a lot of other things I've eaten. For 45 entire minutes.
No, you're not. We'll start you a separate show, the Scone Cast.
He set us a top 8.
Okay. Cheating, but I guess...
In the history of cinema, you couldn't come up with 10.
I know.
What's your deal?
Sheesh.
E.T.
Sure, okay, yes.
Love E.T.
Yes, it's inassailable.
Do you love it less than I do?
It's been a long time since I've seen it, and I suspect it would win me over all over again.
I love E.T.
I love E.T. I think its subsequent Steven Spielberg movies may have cooled me in general, but no, E.T. is great.
Psycho.
Yes, absolutely. Assuming you mean the original and not the Gus Van Sant version.
He actually puts in quotes the Alfred Hitchcock version, of course.
Yay.
Now, here's what they... Would there ever be a person... Would there be any person out there? I mean, I guess there would be.
If it exists,
it's somebody's favorite movie. Would the Gus Van Sant Psycho be anybody's favorite?
Some snotty punk who was just out to annoy people who saw it first, you know, like he saw it when he was 14, and then years later saw the Hitchcock one. It's like, man, the Van Sant.
Right.
You know.
Network.
Yay, awesome.
Ghost World, again. Are we attracting all the Ghost World fans in the world? Is that what's happening?
Maybe.
Is it because we talk about it so much that people wind up putting it on their list? Because we've now, I'm looking through these top 10 lists, and Ghost World is on a lot of them, yeah.
It's, you know, its moment has arrived, apparently.
We're only telling you this because we're such close friends. Female Trouble.
Yay, which we talked about, I think, on another list.
Clerks.
Okay, well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm a fan of most of Kevin Smith's stuff. I have to say, when I saw Clerks the first time, I was like, well, okay, yeah. You know, it had been built up.
Really? Just okay?
Yeah, well, it had been built up a lot.
I laughed my head off. It felt like a bolt of lightning to me when I saw it the first time.
I don't know. I think I just remember by the time I'd seen it, it had played at Sundance and it was already being
sold. I was living in Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
So that's
well, I was in Los Angeles at the time, and it was already being sold to me as this like generation defining artifact.
Yeah.
And so I was.
I think it was.
And it is, yeah. But I think if I'd been able to discover that on my own, I would have been more likely to feel it that way. But it was. I felt too marketed about that one. But I think, you know, I don't think it's his best film, but I think it's an important one, certainly.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Okay. I mean, you know, that's another one that's unassailable.
Entirely subjective, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, because I saw it when I was a teenager and was actually terrified of it. Not because it was a scary movie, but because of all the gay stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, not ready for any of this in my life.
And the thing is, like,
I'm in this theater, I think it's going to get on me, you know?
It's become this, and I don't even have the sort of academic language to describe this, but like, no one really is talking about the movie alone when they talk about that movie. It's impossible, almost, to talk about that movie alone. It's all in the context of it is a piece of a larger sort of interactive performance, you know.
Yeah.
So the thing itself is,
and more than that, it's a piece of
folklore.
Genuinely, that is what it is.
Yeah.
It's
a ritual.
It's part of gay history. It's part of just, you know, freaky person history. It was like this siren.
It's
for all the people that needed it.
It's a starter kit for like teen outsiders.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thing that you get to belong to when you don't belong to anything else.
Right.
And actually, it plays a major role in The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And
really?
And based on the trailer, they seem to have kept that in. So,
And The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Parentheses, don't judge me.
Too late.
Too late. That's why you sent this email in.
Yes.
That movie's stupid.
It's terrible. We did it as the Outfest sing-along last year, and I was like, I mean, there's some good songs in it.
Did people sing along?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
You know, and I mean, I could see where it worked on Broadway, but the movie version is so broad and ridiculous. I mean, like, that you're supposed to accept that living in the same universe is like, you know, Burt Reynolds is a sheriff character and Charles Durning's governor, which is, you know, he's an exaggeration, but it's very funny and very well done. But then you throw in that ridiculous TV reporter played by Dom DeLuise. I was like, wait, what? Where? Huh? Yeah. No. No. You are wrong for liking that. No, I'm kidding. But
all right, here's the last letter. Having just decided to take the Throwing Shade Gang's advice, apparently they...
Thank you, guys.
Apparently they
always mention our show at the end. They do a list of podcasts inspired by us.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Because I'm currently making my... But here's the thing. I've never heard them say us. I've listened to lots of Throwing Shades, and I've
maybe
never
you never
them.
Make it to the end.
Maybe I don't. Because we listen in the car, and then we end up at our destination.
Yeah, I listen to the whole thing at the laundromat. Yeah. You get snippets. By the way, John Lehart was on another podcast called The Bear Crawling Nation, and I was one of the three people they gave him in a Mary Boff kill scenario. And
Boff.
Yeah, it's a clean podcast.
Boff.
And
they say Boff.
Oh, do they?
On that podcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was glad that he didn't answer because I'm sure I would have wound up dead. Anyway, go on.
Having just decided to take the Throwing Shade Gang's advice, I am currently making my way through all of the past podcasts. You mentioned Eva Marie Saint because she was on the boat you were on, and you joked that it would be humorous if small children had a desire to see her. This seemed extra humorous to me in the moment because I discovered with the premiere of The Legend of Korra, the Nickelodeon sequel to Avatar, that she is voicing the new elderly Katara.
Oh.
I'm not sure if she's been in any episode beyond the first, but I thought that was kind of nuts.
So now little kids will clamor to see Eva Marie Saint. That's like how Hal Sparks has this whole Disney Channel following now.
Right.
And, you know, after having been on Queer as Folk, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Alrighty, so... Thank you for joining us.
We're not going to do a DVD
pick. Oh, my goodness, you're right.
DVD it's 10 picks. After 9. We
okay,
have,
okay, let's get...
We have like 2 minutes.
Okay, my DVD pick is not tied to anything. It's a movie that I had forgotten about, and then I looked it up, and it is on DVD, and it's worth seeing because people don't know about it. It's a Blake Edwards farce called Mickey and Maude. It stars Dudley Moore, and he is basically a bigamist But it's presented in a really funny way, and a way that makes sense for the character. He's married to Anne Reinking. He then later becomes married to Amy Irving. They both get pregnant at the same time, at the same hospital, and there's a brilliantly funny sort of Blake Edwards, you know, French farce slamming doors thing of Dudley Moore running back and forth between the two delivery rooms that makes very good use of the CinemaScope, you know, the anamorphic screen, which now that it's on DVD, you can see it that way. Very funny movie that is kind of forgotten about by people, but it made me laugh a lot. Check it out.
I was just on a site called gotchamovies.com. Uh-huh. And I was looking for what's new on Netflix Instant. Mm-hmm. And this came up, even though now I'm looking at it and it says it was new on Netflix Instant on June of 2011. So it might not be up on Netflix Instant anymore. It might just be a DVD, but I'm still going with it.
Okay.
Harry Brown, which is not a great movie, but it is cool in many ways in that...
I'll smash your face.
Yeah. Michael Caine is...
Old.
Old, really old. He's a pensioner and he's being terrorized by teen gangs on his council estate. And one of the teen gangs is led by the British musician Plan B, who goes by his real name of Ben something or other. I forget his last name in this movie. Michael Caine is essentially like an 80-year-old Dirty Harry in this movie, and he kills everybody. And it's... lots of fun on that level. It's again, yeah. There's a lot of problems with the movie. It's not a good movie necessarily, but sure does kill a lot of folk. A lot of folks.
Yeah. If you want to see a bunch of young punks get their heads handed to them by an old guy, this is the movie for you.
It makes Gran Torino look silly.
Look like ladies in lavender.
Yeah. And so, furthermore, he's not got his pants hiked up to his, you know,
as a bonus.
Unlike Clint Eastwood, who is the star of the film titled Hike Your Pants Up, Michael Caine.
Not hiking the pants up. No.
And killing everybody.
As always, we thank you for listening. Let us point you to our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, The Popcorn Mafia, Blowhard, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, which again we're on this week, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash with That Chris Gore, and The Game Night Guys. You can listen to this program. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher Radio or find us at thelounge.com. Or like our page, our Facebook page for Linoleum Knife Podcast. And there's an app on that page where you can listen to the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Linoleum Cast. Check into the show at getglue.com. And always, you can drop us an email with your top 10 list or complaints or praise or questions or whatever else at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
You said that so professionally.
Well, someone's got to.
You sounded like a real announcer when you did that. Anyway, goodbye. All right.